Okay, I want to clarify something that I've said, but I want to say it again. I want to say it better, which is this, that in the secular world, you can read about the biopsychosocial model of mental health. That's a secular model that I think is very valuable. I just did a quick Google search and came up with this. And I'm not even going to link it for you because there's a thousand of these. You know what I mean? Like, it's just out there. So, biopsychosocial. So here's the point. I believe that's very good. I think that's about as good a secular model as you're going to get out there. But what we're going to be doing is adding the spiritual to it once we've covered the mind-body connection, the relationship connection, etc. So we're here on mind-body today. Hopefully we'll get to it. We'll be adding the relationship piece to it. And then what we'll eventually do is incorporate the spiritual as well, which really connects to the body, the mind, and our relationships. So I believe it's valuable. I think there's great value in taking time to understand how God has made us in this. That's obviously why we're spending the first few classes on this. There's value in understanding how God made us. I think that's the kind of wisdom that the Bible presents, the kind of wisdom that Solomon demonstrates, etc. So speaking of Solomon, this is where we picked up. Technically, I went beyond this, but it was so fast on Sunday. A glad heart makes a cheerful face, but by sorrow of heart, the spirit is crushed, right? We talked about those principles of glad heart shows up on your face. Sorrow, you feel that crushed, right? When your spirit is crushed, that's something you feel, right? We talked about the king who is stately in his stride, just like a lion, the rooster, the he-goat, and the king whose army's with him. And that's a mind-body. How does this have to deal with the mind-body connection, this picture of the king stately in his tread?
Confidence
has you to walk different. Yeah, that was very well said. That confidence shows up bodily. And we read that on people all the time, whether we put our finger on it or not. Just we see that. And then Proverbs 14:30, a tranquil heart gives life to the flesh, but envy makes the bones rot. So their envy or jealousy, that you feel that, it wears you down. Whereas a tranquil heart gives life and peace. Are you seeing the mind-body connection that we see here in the Proverbs? Here's more. I think we didn't even... Again, I just raced through these on Sunday. The light of the eyes rejoices the heart, and good news refreshes the bones. So good news, rejuvenating, we feel that, right? And this very room last year, don't be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord, turn away from evil. It will be healing to your flesh and refreshment to your bones. If you were in this class, you know exactly what song I'm talking about with that. So fearing the Lord, doing what's right, blesses your body, healing to your flesh, refreshment to your bones, okay? So here's my favorite one. This one gets its whole slide. Ecclesiastes 10:3. Even when a fool walks on the road, he lacks sense, and he says to everyone that he's a fool. Now, what does that teach us about human nature? By looking at a guy walking down the road, yeah, that's right. And so from one perspective, it's the fact that you can read someone. What about from just the guy himself?
He probably needs to keep his mouth shut.
He will. And he's demonstrating his maturity or immaturity by how he walks. Just in how people walk down the road, you can learn a lot about them. You can see folly from a quarter mile. That's the line, right? And just that sense of, you know, when... My boy played the youngest Hawks group, and there's those young kids who are playing basketball. Some of them are still like literally skipping around the court, right? You don't see high school seniors skipping around the basketball court, but that's just a maturity thing, right? So even how you walk down the road, you can be communicating what's going on. Here's just a connected thing. Experience tells us you can't fake wisdom, right? It's always fascinated me. Actors can play younger characters, right? They're 22, but they can play a high school kid in a TV show or whatever. How successful are actors at portraying someone who's older and successfully looking and portraying someone who's supposed to be old and wise and far beyond their years. It doesn't happen, right? It's very difficult because you can't fake wisdom. You can act younger, you can act less mature, but to really demonstrate maturity is different, okay? So in this Ecclesiastes 10:3, even when a fool walks on the road, he lacks sense. He tells everyone he's a fool. Would we say that this is emphasizing what affecting what? Body affecting the mind or mind affecting the body?
Mind affecting
the mind. That's what I think too. Yep. Okay, so here's some big takeaways from this as we're seeing this presentation in Scripture of this connection between our thoughts, our personality, and then our bodies as well. God made us mind and body together. That's just how God made us. And a great word that describes this, we could say God gave us an embodied mind. Our mind is connected to and is a bodied mind. That's how God created us. So as we'll see, it's not just in our brains, though. It's not just my mind is embodied in my brain. It's really connected in my whole body. So biblically, what that means is my sense of self, of who I am, is not just my thinking. It's my whole body, right? That all who, what I am, the me, or what is me. And we talk about this, I use this illustration a lot. Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? Well, Jesus says that when his body's being persecuted. But when Jesus' body's being persecuted, he doesn't say, why are you persecuting my body? He says, me. You know, that sense of me includes my body. So the body is good, creation is good, and we maybe miss this, but it's biblical to see the body as a good thing. God plans to redeem the body. And that's another class in here from last year, right? The God's plan in the resurrection to raise the body, right? And a great passage just talks about God's plan for the body. 1 Corinthians 6:13. The body is not meant for sexual sin. It's meant for the Lord, and the Lord is there to help the body. The Lord's for the body. God raised the Lord will also raise us up by his power. So that's part of who we are, is this body. It was the pagan Greeks who were kind of the source of Western thought. They thought the body was bad. They thought just intellectual was good. And here we have a legacy in Western thinking of overly intellectual, I believe. So it's we need to see that God made the body. The body is good. God has plans for the body. We're not like a brain that's unfortunately shackled to a body. That's not our view of the self. Okay. Then with that, then, our bodies are broken in this world, and that brokenness may affect our minds, right? The fall didn't just separate us from God. We are broken in mind, we're broken in body, we're broken in relationship. Remember what Paul says about the body in Romans 7:24. Wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? As he struggles in life, He is broken. He's broken in body and in mind. And he doesn't do the things he wants to do. And the things he wants to do, he doesn't do. And it's awful, right? Just him and himself trying to do what's right. But the good news is that Christ came to heal all this. And in fact, that's the picture in Romans and elsewhere, is that healing starts now. That doesn't mean we're going to get where we might like to be in this life. But in the resurrection, it will be completed. It will be completed what starts now. So this whole package of God helping us, changing us, helping our bodies, helping our minds, helping our relationships, all of that starts now as God is glorifying us now and restoring us now. Okay, so those are some big takeaways of this mind-body connection that we've been hitting at in the last couple classes. Thoughts, questions on that? Those who haven't been here, have you been able to get to the website and listen to classes and utilize slides, the slides and stuff? Okay, Tom?
Well, I was gonna say that you have a mind-body connection with someone through the sense of touch. I know that you've got something going on and somebody just puts their hand on their shoulder or gives you a little hug or whatever like that. And that, it might not be words spoken, but it's feelings transferred.
So that's a great example of the bio and the psycho and the social. Mind-body in relationship, right? Mm-hmm. Mind-body in relationship is just a hug from someone that is encouraging, right? Another dynamic, the New Testament talks about the holy kiss. That's an affectionate thing. Mm-hmm. That's a relationship, but it's not formal, like a handshake. It's an affectionate thing. So Tom, what you're telling me is a hug from someone else is more effective than me hugging myself?
Yes.
Okay, so there's benefit in relationship, right? Yeah. God made us to not just hug myself, but to be in relationship with other people. Yeah, very good. Okay, so here's where we're going to go with some of this. I'm just going to introduce this, but we'll come back to it later. Stress is stored in the body. Or we feel it in our minds, of course, but stress is stored in the body. People store their stress in different ways, right? You could be a headache person, a tension headache person. You could be the shoulder guy. You could be the one who gets stomach aches, right? There's the families that they sit there in church and one knee is bouncing the whole time, right? And you look down the pew and like everyone in the family, they're all bouncing. Like if those bounces happened at the same moment, you would like break the pew, you know? If it was unified together. So whatever it is, we store our stress in our bodies in different ways, of course. Sometimes our muscles are literally holding thoughts, and just you'll kind of see that show up in different ways, kind of like trying to keep thoughts away, the picture of like holding the beach balls under the water. And so sometimes that's part of our tension, is we kind of can't abide certain things, and our tension, our muscles keeping that away. Sometimes you let go of thoughts, you say, I'm going to trust God, or I'm not going to worry about that, and you feel a bodily release, like your muscles release when you let go of a mental thought. It's just fascinating. So we'll see more about this later, but that's where we're going with some of this. Another thing that I'm going to introduce here, but we'll get into more later, God willing, is we don't want to be too much in our head and not in our bodies, because that's not how God made us. And so a lot of times in our anxiety, especially, we're not feeling grounded in our bodies when we're in our heads. And that's not helpful. That's a challenge we try to improve. Stress and trauma can cause us not to be grounded well in our bodies. That can have all kinds of consequences. In extreme situations, panic, trauma make you feel completely outside of your body. You feel very much like you can't handle life. You can't handle these things. So you just kind of feel really in your head, dissociated from those things. So, you know, I had this slide ready. I was planning to talk about this. And one of my boys today told me, literally this afternoon, he told me about a time in the past week he was so stressed, he felt like he was out of his body. I was like, you said that at the perfect time. Like, I'm talking about that tonight. And so that was perfect. You can't make this stuff up. So, and he doesn't have a tendency to do that. People with panic attacks are more likely to more regularly feel that. But that he was just like, I was so stressed, I felt like I was out of my body. And he was about to be playing a basketball game. And he was like, how's this going to go? So, you can live your whole life and not realize that you're not well grounded in your body. You may not know the difference, but getting in our bodies tends to help anxiety. If we're stuck in emotions, being in our body kind of helps us to process and move forward with our life. It can help sexual problems, things like that. So you just think about it, that's a natural consequence. God gave us a body and a mind, but if we're not really in our bodies and we're up here, you see that in people. You can see it from quarter mile, right? They're rigid, they're paralyzed, or they're tense, and they're all up here. The wheels are spinning, but they're not grounded in their body. Well, that connects us to the homework, which was to read Song of Solomon. And we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, but here's the questions I asked. Observe anything that looks like mind-body connection. Ask how these people feel about their bodies. And you get the sense of what we just talked about. You get the sense these people are in their bodies and grounded in their bodies. So I'm just going to make some observations there. I'll open up for other observations, but I don't want to spend too much time on this. In Song of Solomon, romance is experienced with the whole body. I don't just mean the sexual aspect of romance. I just mean romance as a whole. So like Song of Solomon 2:14, let me hear your voice. Your voice is sweet. Your face is lovely. So he hears her voice, and that's this pleasing thing. You know, that's a sensory input that he's, you know, loving, right? Experiencing that. 4:9, you've captivated my heart, my sister, my bride. You've captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes. So he just sees her eyes, and he's captivated. So that kind of romance experience there of just that look, right? You have the sick with love expression, how overpowering romance can be. I get the sense, reading it, they're very much in their bodies in this healthy way, like we just discussed. Certainly a healthy view of human relationships, sexuality, things like that. Here's a mind-body thing we see in the book. Love blinds us. Love intoxicates us, right? Be drunk with love. That's this whole body, you know, relationship intoxicating thing. And I like this in 6:12, desire transports us. Before I realized, you know, I saw you, my desire set me among the chariots of my kinsman, a prince. So it's like the minute I saw you, I was, you know, ushered away and I was with the chariots, you know, kind of brought to another place, kind of transporting them. So there's some thoughts that I pulled out that I think are connected to what we've been talking about in class. Any other thoughts that, or something that you noticed that you'd like to share with the class?
So much about how he talks about the senses. Mm-hmm. He does and he does.
Yep.
The smell, mm-hmm. The touch.
Cinnamon, cassia, yep. Honey, yep. Yep, good. So kind of this whole in your body experience kind of thing. Good. Anything else someone wants to add?
Well, so, you know, part of Song of Solomon is possibly he's dreaming, she's dreaming.
Yes, whatever. Yes.
So is that, so are you thinking of that as an out of, like, you're not really in your... I'm like looking at that thinking,
okay, that's an interesting thought. Yeah, you have the dream thing in chapter 3 and 5. I see that. I don't see that as them not being in their body. I think the takeaway there is this longing, and the first dream is like, where are you? Oh, I found you. The second dream is, where are you? Oh, things are awful. Where'd you go? You know, that kind of. And so it's this kind of this longing for the relationship that has this kind of overpowering sense to it. So, could we have applied Song of Solomon to the relationship piece? Yes. But we could do that with any passage I give you is the problem. So we're going to look at Psalm 131. I was going to do it for biopsycho. I was like, no, let's wait for biopsychosocial because all of them have this kind of interwoven thing to it. Was there another hand? Yeah, Jason.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this idea that, I mean, we've all kind of probably been there where we've had this crush or this love and you feel like you're on cloud nine. I mean, not like you're literally out of your body, but you just feel so happy,
so good,
excited,
yes,
really on a high. And that, to me, that's that intoxication that I'm just, life could be better because,
yes,
of this love that I feel. And again, I think, you know, obviously something we clearly learn from that as we mature is we think about that feeling, we think about growing and maturing in our feeling towards God in that same way, and where we're just so happy and excited to get up every day because of that. And
yeah, growing in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So to me, it's so intertwined and connected, our emotion and how we feel, connected
good
to the things we see and experience and touch and smell and hear and taste. And
yes,
it's just.
Yeah, all
love just embodies that.
It does. It does. In all those ways.
Yes.
Good. So you mentioned emotions. So that's actually kind of where we're going next as we continue to talk about mind-body stuff. So I'm going to reference this book now, and then you'll see it in the corner there. It's called The Soul of Shame. I've recommended this book to others. Is it still in your stack, or have you read it yet?
I started.
Okay. So in the middle of it. It's a really interesting book. He's a believer. And he's a neuroscientist, so he writes about neurology from a Christian perspective. And it's a really interesting book for that reason. It's a hard read. You have to read stuff a couple of times. What is he getting at? But it's a really interesting blend of Christian devotional and neuroscience. So one chapter is like about the brain, and the next chapter is talking about like Christian groups of, you know, encouraging each other and, you know, just that kind of thing. And he's written other books, but his specialty is interpersonal neurobiology, which itself, the fact that there is even a field of study of interpersonal neurobiology is itself unexpected and really interesting, because the whole point is studying how my brain works in relationship to other people. You see, that's almost kind of, it seems like an oxymoron. My brain shouldn't be about other people, my brain's about me, but it's a study of neurology with connections to other people. So I have several quotes from this book in some of these upcoming slides. So that's what that book is. And I recommend it, just I think he has some helpful things in there. Okay, so if so much of our thinking world and relationship world has these physical factors, right? We talked about the physical element. Does that mean that we can't change? That's an idea that's out there, and I think is confusing to people. There's a guy I talked to, he has OCD. His wife, I think, is trying to be supportive, but he mentions the fact that OCD has a genetic component. And she says to him, well, if OCD is genetic, then what's the point of going to therapy? Right? That seems like a natural question, you know? It's like you're born with a sixth finger on your hand. You don't go to mental health therapy to remove your extra finger, right? So here's the good news, is that God has made our brains to be very, very good at changing and growing and adapting. Our brains are made to change. Now, if you've studied this before, there's a fun word of this. What do scientists call the ability of our brains to keep changing? You know, that word? Neuroplasticity. Very good, very good. Neuroplasticity. That God has made our brains to form new connections, new pathways, even new neurons. And so neuroplasticity is huge because it means there's always the potential for change. So here's a...
Jamie,
yes.
On that trying to change, so I went through physical therapy, and that's part of what they're trying to trigger in my brain to help heal it.
Yes.
But you have to push your limits.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And most people are not willing to push the hard stuff to actually make that work.
It is. It is very difficult because the more we've done something, those neurological connections become deeper and deeper ruts. You know, the statement, the neurons that fire together wire together. So the more I do something, the more it becomes second nature. So to change that can be really hard, especially if it's something I've done my whole life, you know, but it is possible. Absolutely. So I think it's a great connection there. Yeah, Jason.
Sorry, that just reminded me of a life experience, and I'm not experiencing it anymore, but back whenever I decided I was going to run, right? Running is physical, but it's extremely mental because you can't overcome that until you start to overcome it. And then all of a sudden you're running 13 miles and you couldn't run a mile the very first time you went out and did it. It's as much mental as it is mm-hmm. physical. It's amazing how intertwined all of that
absolutely,
is.
Absolutely, yes.
And and how your body can respond through the training and the change, and your mind begins to change, and you think differently about it than you did when you first started.
Yes, absolutely. God's made our brains to be amazing. That idea that our brains are made to change. They're not made to stay put. They will keep changing. Okay, so you get to hear his wordiness here, but he goes from neurology here, and then the next slide has Romans 12 quote. So that's just kind of the nature of that book. Okay. Evidence accumulated in the last 3 decades indicates that brain cells have a greater capacity for adaptation and regeneration than was previously believed. This characteristic is generally referred to as neuroplasticity. This property of neurons allows for the connection between different domains of the brain and thereby different functional components, such as sensations, images, feelings, thoughts, and body actions. This is popularly recounted in what's become known as Hebb's axiom in honor of the Canadian neurophysicist Hebb. The neurons that fire together wire together. In other words, if you associate things together, then that association becomes more and more permanent. They wire together. In essence, the more we practice activating particular neural networks, the more easy they are to activate, the more permanent they become in the brain. So here's where he goes with that. In the epistle to the church in Rome, St. Paul suggests that renewal is possible. Romans 12:1. I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and pleasing to God. This is your true and proper worship. Do not be conformed to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you'll be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. It's fair to say that although Paul was not a neuroscientist, he here refers to what we now see through the lens of neuroplasticity. Renewal of the mind, therefore, is not just an abstraction. It means real change in real bodies. Isn't that really interesting? That we really can change, really can change our mind and be transformed. Real change in real bodies. So what neuroplasticity means is we can keep growing and changing in our life. So I may be born with a biological propensity towards something, right? We've mentioned some mental health things that have more of a genetic component to it, others less. So I may have a biological propensity towards a mental dysfunction even from birth. And then my life experiences, which may be quite unpleasant, may push me more and more in that direction, right? But I can always start moving things in the right direction and literally change my brain. And so it's a powerful truth to know that I can change. And this old, like, born this way model, that's just not fair. That's not accurate. It doesn't reflect the potential of our brains to grow and to adapt. So that's the good news of how God made us. Okay, comments, questions, thoughts on that? Yeah.
So I just wanted to say that this whole concept of neuroplasticity is fairly new within the whole field. And when I say fairly new, his quote said 30 years, but I would say maybe 50 years down. So there's a lot of...
Well, this was written 10 years ago, so...
Okay, well then, even more so. But there's a lot of ideas and about all of this that are inaccurate that people have listened to over the years. And so it's gotten a bad name, basically. But now, as we've learned more about neuroplasticity and how the brain operates, it all lines up with the scripture like you were talking about. So I think that's wonderful.
Yeah.
But we find that we're still fighting a lot of misconceptions about
it. Okay, interesting. And at some point, I'd love to hear, you know, kind of all about that, because that is interesting. Any other comments or questions on neuroplasticity? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking about the worldview of this. Right, how popular it was to begin to talk about alcoholism as a disease rather than something that you could overcome.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's interesting. It's like taking something that there is fact to, right, where it could be genetic, it could be something, right, but it doesn't mean you can't control it or learn to control it.
Yeah,
or transform,
right. Yes.
Into controlling it. It's just amazing to me how the world can maybe get close, but they it's twisted in a view of man indulging in their own, what they want to do.
Yeah, well,
seeing the transformation.
Yeah, we've always wanted excuses to do what we want to do. So, you know, it naturally became that kind of thing. Good. So let's talk about emotions then. So as we talked about the mind-body connection, it's still where we are. That's the symbol, mind-body connection. And these are emojis, if you haven't seen those before. Would we label emotions as our thinking or our body? Is it the psycho part or the bio part? Is our emotions our thinking or our body? So who votes for thinking? Okay, another hand. Who votes for body? No one.
Who votes for both?
Okay, who votes for both? There you go, tricky question, okay, yeah. Okay, so emotions really are both. Emotions are much more somatic, that is with our bodies, involving our bodies, and more physical than we maybe realize. That emotions really are felt in our bodies. One definition of emotions are a bodily commotion. It's catchy, right? You can remember that. Emotions are felt in our bodies. Our physical bodies are the home of emotions. And so it really is, again, this kind of, it's helpful to see me as a person, my heart, who I am. When I'm feeling these emotions, that's not just in my head. There's a body part to that, a somatic part. This sounds silly, but it's true. If you're not feeling emotions, we're not feeling emotions. You know what I mean? If you're not feeling them, then you don't have emotions. They're only existing when you're feeling them. So if you're not feeling emotions, you're not feeling emotions. You see that? Now, if we have a purely rational brain, like our friends Spock and Data, right, who fictional characters in Star Trek who are very, very, very cerebral, not emotional, right? If you have a purely rational brain, then by definition, then they're not emotional, right? That's kind of the whole point of those characters is they're not emotional because they're just rational, right? And so just kind of trying to paint this picture for us here. And maybe here's what we don't appreciate is that we're always in some kind of emotional state. Now, you may not be aware of it most of the time, but if we pause, we may notice it, and the emotional part of our brain is activating. We're always in some kind of emotional state. So, you know, it's kind of false to say, you know, you can remove all emotion. As people in a body, in an embodied mind, there's emotions that are always kind of going on. So here's Dr. Thompson's on that. The mind is embodied. It's not some abstraction that exists somewhere in the subjective ether, nor is it merely limited to the brain, but rather, via the brain's extended nervous system, the mind interacts with the world, both inside our skin and outside our skin. We know we're anxious by the nature of our sweaty palms or increased pulse. When we're in love, this is kind of what Jason was getting at, when we're in love, we don't just love the object of our affections, we love what we feel inside ourselves when we are with or think of him or her, the flutter in our chest, the lightness of our perceived mood. And those functions are perceived as much a function of our bodies as anything else. Were it not for our fully embodied experience of our mind, we'd be unaware of much of what our mind is trying to tell us. Does that make sense? If we didn't really have this bodily emotional thing going on, we would overlook that or ignore that. We're missing a lot of what our mind's trying to tell us, what life is kind of about. So that's just the nature of how God made us. Well, so here's an interesting question. When the Bible talks about our heart, so what's our heart then? How do we label that? So we're going to give our mind-body guy a nice heart here, right? I like this definition of the heart. The heart is the inner man. That's just kind of simple. I like that. Your heart is your inner person, right? Your thinking, your feelings, your emotions, your motivation, your volition. Volition's an old school word. What's volition?
Will.
Will, choosing, right? Your desires, your character. So maybe no surprise, here's where I'm going with this. I'm suggesting that the heart, if it's the inner person, is both mind and body in who we are, right? That my heart is me, but since me is mind and body, then that's my heart as well. Just some ways we use the words differently. When we talk about our mind, we tend to think of being rational or irrational, right? He's lost his mind. It doesn't mean he doesn't have emotions. It means he's not being a rational person anymore, right? He's a broken mind. It means you're not thinking well. Is that quite how we talk about the heart? It's not. Instead, when I say a broken mind, it means
brokenhearted.
Exactly. So when we say a broken heart, do we mean an irrational heart? What do we mean by a broken heart?
Disappointed.
Sad. And what is sadness? That's a emotion. Very good. So the heart, we tend to link with emotions. An angry heart, a broken, sad heart, a fearful heart, a joyful heart. So we do use the phrase a broken heart, but we really are talking about an emotion or anger or joy. Proverbs 17:22, a happy heart makes good medicine. You know, and plus, we use a body part to describe it. We call it our heart, which is a part of our physical bodies. So I think that helps us feel like my heart is like partly at least physical. So in short, the heart is not just our mind. Our heart is our whole inner person, flesh and spirit, body and mind together. So that's my perspective on that. Comments or questions or thoughts on that as we talk about how God made us here. Okay, that's all I have for now with the mind-body. So we've looked at how God made you by yourself, mind and body, soul, spirit, flesh, my heart, my thinking, my feeling. And then we have relationships to other people. So now we're going to jump into the relationship piece of this. Again, right now in class, our only goal in this class and the next class, and maybe the next one, whatever, is just to be looking at how God made us, just to understand our nature here. So here's our homework that I'm going to introduce now, and then we'll see how many slides we get past this. It's a video I want you to watch. It's by a guy named Dr. Yapko, Michael Yapko. It's called How to Recover from Depression. You can find it on YouTube. It has 5.5 million views. It's from a few years back. He's not a believer. I scoured the internet trying to figure out if he's a believer or not. So if he is, he's hiding it very well. I don't think he's a believer. But I think you'll really enjoy the video. The primary reason I want you to watch it is because I want you to see the biopsychosocial model in action. And of course, I can email this out even, or whatever. But I want you to see the mind-body relationship piece in action. And I think it's maybe even more powerful to see that this is from a secular perspective, that I think the wisdom that he has about this is not just because he's some Bible beater out there. So watch this. It's really good. Now, I wanted to go back through and just make sure he didn't like say any bad words. So I didn't go back and do that. It's been a while since I've watched it. But as you watch this, like I said, I think you'll like it. I think you'll benefit from it. The point is not to focus on depression, even though that's his focus. We'll talk about depression later on in the quarter, God willing. The point right now is I just want you to see someone talking about biopsychosocial altogether. As you listen to it, any surprises in what he talks about? And even though he's not presenting this from a Christian perspective, does his basic model align with biblical principles? I, of course, think it does. That's why I'm offering it. When you start the video, he's American. He's speaking in the country of Australia. So that's how you know you're watching the right video. There's the title. There's the name of it, cyclopedia.org. And then when he talks about this conference in Australia, then that's the video. Okay, questions on the homework. It's about an hour long, so you don't want to do this Sunday morning before service.
Repeat them again. List any surprises of what was the second.
Yeah, any surprises on the data he presented or perspective, and then does his basic model align with the Bible? He's not presenting it from a Christian perspective, but does his basic model align with biblical principles? And I've recommended this video in particular to one individual I talked to who struggles with depression, just because I think he says some really helpful things. So I suspect, we're not going to, but I suspect we could talk just about this video in our next class, just because I think you'll find a lot in there that I think is noteworthy or pleasantly surprised with, or things like that. Okay. So when we talk about relationships, we don't mean how relationships look on the outside, right? Your friendship with someone might be fine. Your friendship might look fine, but in your heart, that friendship is actually fairly discouraging, right? So that's not the goal. On the other hand, some married couples are fairly used to conflict. They may just are used to...
5-minute warning.
That's how they've always lived. That's how they're going to live. And so it looks like they're always fighting, but actually their relationship's fine. It's fairly stable. That's just how they operate. I'm not recommending that. I'm just saying that there's couples out there that's true. So really what relationship is about is if you've had and currently have supportive relationships in your life. So it's really about what's in your heart in relationships. Have had in the past and then hopefully currently have supportive relationships. That's what we're talking about. Another thing when we say relationship, we don't mean with living people necessarily, because it could be that the people whose relationships were most important to you have all passed, right? If you're older, all the supportive relationships you had, you may have had a life full of good relationships, and they're all gone. But that encouraging relationship is still in your heart, right? That became part of who you are. And was a very helpful thing to you and have stabilized your life, right? So it's really about the people in your life that you have the strongest connection to that we're talking about here. So when I say relationships, you say, well, I never talk to my parents anymore, right? I'm 40 years old. I don't talk to mom and dad. Well, no. It could very well be that how those relationships were and maybe the fact that you don't currently have a good relationship. That actually might be some of the most significant relationships in who you are, not because you talk to them a lot, but because of the emotional impact of it. Does that make sense? So we're really talking about emotional impact, not about who you call on the phone. Now, who you call on the phone, is that part of your life? Yes, but we're not necessarily just saying, who are the top 10 people that you talk to the most? Sometimes it's just people in general. I think people in general have a potential to bring us down or influence us or impact us more than other factors. So here's the point. People, more than we probably realize, have huge impact on our emotions and our thinking and our body. So naturally, that's where we're going, right? This relationship piece affects my body. This relationship piece affects my thinking. study on World War II kids in London who were sent away from their parents. You know, Peter, Susan, Lucy, and Edmund, right? And they're in London when the Germans are bombing it, so they send all these London kids out into the countryside, right? So, like the kids in Narnia, many kids were sent out of London when it was regularly being bombarded by the Nazis. And it seemed like a good idea at the time, right? Send them away. This is a stressful place to be. We don't want them to die. They're just going to be traumatized if they live through here. Well, what they found is the evacuated children taken away from their parents were actually more negatively impacted long-term than the kids who stayed with their parents. And that was true the younger they were taken away. In other words, it's better to be with your parents when your home's being bombed than to be separated from your parents and put in a calm environment away from them. Isn't that kind of shocking? But I think we feel the value of that, that being able to be with those people you care about that stabilize us is very significant to who we are. So I think that study, and of course that's super hard to measure, because what are they doing? They're surveying adults long after the fact. You know, you think, how do you psychologically measure this data? You know, but I think that's notable. I always think about this in terms of just people. Tim Bunning talking about living in New York. What's hard about living in the city is not the annoyances of the subway or traffic or everything dirty. It's the people. If the people weren't so terrible, New York would be a wonderful place to live. It's the people that make your life so frustrating, right? That's the big thing that is so stressful, that is so hard, that's so discouraging, is people. And that's kind of where we're going with all this. So see how far we get in this quote before that bell rings. The mind is as relational as it is embodied. By this, I mean that the very emergence of the mind's capacity to do what it does is crucially dependent on the presence of relationships. From the day we enter the world, our neurons are firing not only out of the depths of our physical, genetically influenced patterns, but also in response to the myriad of social interactions we sense and perceive when we encounter other people. Not only this, data from the field of epigenetics now suggest the human experience has the capacity to turn genes on and off. Isn't that fascinating? Human experience has the capacity to turn genes on and off. In this way, our relational interactions can actually influence our lives at the most basic biological level. Relationships impact our bodies. Thus, the way our neurological system wires its responses to various emotional experiences is significantly influenced by the relational context in which these emotions arise.
End of class.
So that's where we're going with this, is talking about then relationship, how God has made us for relationship. Okay, thank you all so much for your participation.